Welcome to Optimal Health for Busy Entrepreneurs, the podcast for busy and high-performing entrepreneurs and leaders who are looking to create more energy and optimize their health while upgrading their brain and personal performance with precision. I am your host, Julian Hayes II. I've been involved with health and performance for over a decade. This podcast was created for the high performer who is unapologetically ambitious, the one who moves at a fast pace and operates with an edge, the one who wants to become superhuman. Nothing here is fluff, gimmicky, or feel good. I have little to no interest in simply helping you improve your life. I want to help transform it. By listening to this podcast, expect to have a body that feels just as good as it looks. Expect to possess a swagger and style that gives off an infectious vibe. Expect to command the stage or any boardroom you walk into with your executive presence. And lastly, expect to become your most enhanced self so you can live a limitless life. Now, let's get to the show. Another episode of Optimeers. I'm your host, Julian Hayes II, back at it again with another fascinating entrepreneur, a fellow entrepreneur that is actually local to the area, just not local today, but it's probably the first time in the Nashville area, so this is pretty cool. So a little bit about him is that he is currently the CEO and co-founder of GreenPal, which is the Uber for lawn care. Previously, he funded Peachtree Inc., which is one of the largest landscaping companies in the state of Tennessee. Grew it to over $10 million in annual revenue before it was acquired in 2013 by Lucid Holdings. I am here with none other than Brian Clayton. Brian, how's it going, man?
I'm doing great, Julian. Thanks for having me on your show.
Yeah, man. Happy to talk with you, man. Happy to talk with someone local.
Awesome. So, right on. Nashville, Tennessee, and, holding it down.
Exactly. So we got to talk, you know, because if people are watching the video and as I'm talking to you now, you're obviously not in the office. So you're in Barcelona. So how's life in Barcelona?
I'm in Barcelona, Spain. It's my first time in Spain. Loving it. It's great out here. Believe the hype. Yeah, it's a cool place, man. Cool part of the world. And that's one of the cool things about getting a business going is that it enables you to kind of travel and do things on your own terms. So, but don't make no mistake. You can't travel and start a business from scratch. You got to put in the work first.
Yeah. That's the funny thing. So a little bit about me, because we're kind of just meeting each other, is that when I first saw this lifestyle, you know, I saw people traveling, doing things on their own terms and still having business. And I wanted all of that at once. And I quickly found out that you can anything you want. Kind of like I tell clients with their health, you can get all these goals, you know, run these marathons, do all these different anti-aging things, but you can't do it all at once. It's right. piece by piece that compounds over time with that.
Exactly. I found the same thing. It's hard to have everything, but if you can strike a little balance with all these different kind of, I guess you could say silos in your life, you can almost have it all. And for me, I've had journeys in starting my business that I let my personal health neglect and I let my personal health fall by the wayside. And I wish I hadn't done that. It was actually avoidable. So I agree with everything you're saying.
So let's dive into your origin story. So how'd you get started with entrepreneurship? Were you one of those people where as a kid, you just know I sold lemonade stands and I was an entrepreneur at heart? Or are you someone kind of like myself where it's a late bloomer? I was mostly a student for most of my life, left school, finally decided to jump in. Which one were you?
Yeah, for me, I was actually forced into entrepreneurship kicking and screaming by my father. He, on a hot summer day, he said, "Get off your butt. You got a job to do. You're going to go mow the neighbor's grass." Made me go cut the neighbor's yard. Luckily, he did that because I made $20 and I thought, this is awesome. I don't have to hassle my parents for money anymore. I'm sold. And so like I passed out a bunch of flyers that first summer and like had like 10 customers at the end of that first summer, 15 years old. And I stuck with this little lawn mowing business. I mowed grass all through high school and all through college. And when I graduated college, I had to make a decision. Was I going to go into the job market and take a pay cut or stick with this little lawn mowing business? And stuck with the business, made a little business plan that, you know, using the things I learned in business school and 15 years later, I had built one of the biggest landscaping companies in the state of Tennessee, eventually getting it over 150 employees, $10 million a year in revenue. And then in 2013, ended up getting the business acquired by one of the largest landscaping companies in the United States. And then after that, I retired, took some time off, but I was young. I was only like 33 years old at the time. And I thought, man, you know, I'm like kind of wired to want to like do more than just chill out on a beach. And so I had the idea for Green Pal, which is a company I'm working on now, which is like the Uber for lawn mowing. And I thought, well, the last company was really hard. I don't want to do that again. I want to do a software business now because that should be a little easier. And it was like naivete as an asset. I didn't know how hard it was going to be. If I had known how hard it was going to be, I never would have done it. But recruited two co-founders. We got in the game, started hacking away on the project. And here we are almost 10 years later. We're a 10-year overnight success. Started very humbly in Nashville, Tennessee, hustling this thing together. Spent 4 years just in Nashville. But now we're nationwide, a few hundred thousand people using the app, doing multiple eight figures a year in revenue, all self-funded, no debt, no outside capital, and profitable, which is kind of rare for tech startups. So that's 22 years, two businesses, both over eight figures, never taken on investors, one exit, one industry, blue collar, and then tech. So that's kind of me in 22 in 2 minutes.
Yeah, that's a lot to pack into there. And so I guess the first initial thing that people may hear is that you have it's a tech company, it's a business. And typically when we think about that, we think about funding Series A, Series B, finding some way. And so getting bootstrapping, starting the business with no money or little money, I don't know. But what would you say to entrepreneurs that are taking that route?
Yeah, it was started the business with very little money. We purposely did not take on outside capital. And for me, you know, I'm not anti-VC, but the reality is for most entrepreneurs thinking about taking on outside venture capital, it's usually a bad bet. And here's why. What you don't realize is like, venture capital sets you off on this path, a chain reaction of events to where you're like 50 Cent, get rich or die trying. You have to hit a grand slam or you're going to strike out. There's very rare, it's highly unusual where somebody hits a single or a double and has a favorable outcome. Usually the investor dollars will gobble those proceeds up. And so it's usually a bad bet to raise VC. Now, when it works, it's beautiful. And, you know, when somebody moves to Hollywood and they become a famous actor or actress or a big pop singer, it's beautiful. But the reality is, it's like 10,000 people come to Nashville every year to become the next big country thing. And one makes it, maybe. That's kind of how the dynamics of venture capital play out. It's the power law on steroids. And, you know, it's usually a bad bet if you're going to raise, you know, $1 million or $2 or $3 million of capital. You got to raise 10, you got to raise 20, then you got to raise 50. You're going to have to, you know, build a multi-hundred million dollar, billion dollar company. And that's about a 1 in 1,000 bet. For me, so there's one school of thought to look at it. You can say, well, you just do that 3 times over 10 years and you'll have to have a decent outcome. Just keep swinging and keep raising money. And that's true. And that does happen. But that means you got to have like 3 or 4 really good ideas. I didn't have that many good ideas. I had one good idea. I had Green Pal. I had 15 years of industry experience building a landscaping company. I saw where technology could make the whole thing run better. And so this was kind of like my one shot. And so I didn't want to set forth like a dynamic where we wouldn't be in control of our own destiny and we you know wouldn't be able to reach the finish line through any other means other than just time and hard work. And so for us, it was the right path. It's not necessarily say like taking on venture capital is stupid. It's just if you do that, you need to kind of know what you're signing up for. And two more points, and then I'll quit talking about it. But you look on your phone, you know, every app on your home screen is venture-backed, no doubt, or else it wouldn't be there. So, like, then you think, okay, well, I have to go raise venture money then. But then you observe stuff like Y Combinator, which is the NFL of the NFL of the NFL of seed funding. Like, if you get into Y Combinator, it's like getting into Princeton, Harvard, and Stanford all at one for starting your tech company. So first off, really hard to get into. Second, these guys are behind the names of like Airbnb, Instacart, Stripe, DoorDash, Reddit. The list goes on and on and on. There's probably 60, 70 household blue chip names you've heard of that these guys are behind. So you think, well, I'll just get into that and I'll get rich. But what you also don't realize is those dudes have funded 4,000 companies. So it's like 70 names that matter out of 4,000. So even if you get into the upper echelon of an accelerator, your chances are still very, 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 very small of catching lightning in a bottle by going the VC back route.
Wow, that's really small odds. Still,
still,
and it's kind of like we always hear the success. We always hear the success stories. We always hear the outliers. We always hear. Like even in business, you're the person who in 1 year built a seven-figure company, but we don't hear about the thousands of other entrepreneurs who were in the negative for that year, or even the next 2 years, you know. So it kind of sets up these crazy warped expectations. And I know this personally because it warped my mind, and it wasn't until like actual mentorship of understanding that, hey, these things take time to actually build something sustainable and actually profitable.
Yep. And the thing that I'll add to your point is you look at the 1 year, 2 year, $100 million outcome, and it's like, holy crap, how did they do that in 2 years? What you don't realize is like that founder already crashed and burned on like three things before that. The thing you're looking at was actually named something else for 5 years. And they also had two other people on their founding team that had already sold $10 million businesses. So they were starting on third base. And so me starting as an entrepreneur with no track record, that's how I was when I started GreenPal. Even though I had an exit under my belt, I still had no track record in the tech space. And starting from zero, the odds of a billion-dollar outcome on that first swing is really unlikely. And even the seemingly overnight successes usually are the product of 5, 10, 15, and 20 years of experience and different things that didn't work that they rolled into the thing that did work. You know, take Uber, for example. Uber, you know, 2 year overnight success started in 2011. By 2013, they were already off and going. And like, you know, what you don't realize is like Travis Kalanick has like had two or three exits already. He was like already worth $10 million. Garrett Camp, the co-founder, founded StumbleUpon and sold it for $30 million. So like these were guys that already knew the nuances of getting a tech company going from scratch, could already raise massive amounts of money off of very little proof points and data. If you haven't done any of that stuff before, you're not going to be able to do it out of the gate. It's going to take time.
Yeah. So I felt such an immediate sigh of release and my stress levels went down when I just finally grasped that in my head that it's going to take time. And it's funny because this is the same thing I preach in the health world, that it's going to take time. But for some reason in my head, I thought I could skip the process of like all these other people. And these are some of the things that you don't see in the course that's all around the internet right now is who's actually backing you? Who do these people have in their corner? So I'm glad you're saying this. And so I'm curious, what's the difference of mentality since you kind of existed in both worlds, a tech business and a non-tech business? What's been the biggest mental differences?
There's several. So a couple things. One, you're running a traditional blue collar business. Odds are you are running a known business model that you can look at other companies are doing and kind of emulate and just do better. That's what I did with my landscaping company. I had a landscaping company in Nashville. I had, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 employees. I was looking at companies that had 20 employees. I was like, how can I do that better? And then I was looking at companies that had 100 employees, and I would fly to different cities, and I would just emulate what bigger companies were doing and just flat out do it better. And so when you're running a traditional style business, that's a pretty good playbook. Now, when you're running a tech company, most of the time you're inventing from scratch, a brand new service, a brand new type of company, a brand new type of way to solve a problem. And that's 10 times harder than just running a traditional known business model and just doing it better. And I didn't know that. You know, when I started GreenPal, I thought, well, we'll just build a software and we'll be off and going. And I was inventing a brand new product. People weren't pushing a button and getting the grass cut. People weren't pushing a button and summoning a landscaper. And so this was like new to everybody, new to the landscaper, new to the people using it, market it, all this stuff was new. And so that took a lot of time to figure out just through trial and error. So that's a very different thing. On the side, when you're running a tech company, usually every problem you face, you can solve with technology, which is cool. You run a landscaping company or any kind of traditional business, construction company, bakery, hair salon. There's like the same 100 problems you're going to face day in and day out over and over and over and over and over again. And there really isn't a technological solution for them. I mean, there could be, but not today. And when you're running a tech business, you can solve most every problem with technology. You go through the Eric Ries methodology of asking why five times. You know, why did this happen? You ask that five times, and you can get to the root cause of whatever that is. And usually, there is a software solution to solve that problem. For example, GreenPal. You know, a million things can go wrong between tall grass, hiring somebody to come cut your grass. Their kid was sick. Their equipment got stolen. They didn't feel like working that day. It rained. They didn't know the grass was 4 feet tall when they looked at it on Google Maps. They got the street name wrong. The house number was wrong. The back gate got left unlocked. They let the dog out. A million things can go wrong. And you can ask why five times every single time. Well, why did they let the dog out? Well, as it turns out, they didn't know there was a dog. Well, why did they know there was a dog? Well, because on the schedule, there wasn't anything that mentioned about a dog. Okay, well, maybe somewhere in the sign-up flow, we put, you know, do you have any pets? And then another, like, sign-up flow that comes after that. Okay, tell us about your pet and what day do you need it done, and are you going to lock? So it's a sign-up flow problem when you ask why five times. And that's an example of technology being able to solve a problem in the real world that's inherent to starting a company that's a tech company.
Yeah. And so I want to go back a little bit in terms of the business and at the beginning. And so as I was going through your social profiles and everything, there's a couple of tweets and that stood out to me. And one of those is in a paraphrase that starting a business is very humbling. So if you want to humble yourself, starting a business. And so I guess what was kind of the impetus and let's expound on that.
Yeah, you want to do the most humbling thing you can do with your life, start a business, because you're going to quickly find out. And I don't want to be cynical, but nobody cares. You are going to have to want to will this thing into existence with like all of your soul. You're going to want to have to see it come alive, and you're going to be the person to breathe life into it, because all ideas are like stillborn, and you're going to be the person breathing life into this, and it's going to be from a intrinsic thing inside of you. And not an extrinsic thing that, you know, you're doing it because of an extrinsic value. Like, nobody's going to give a shit. And you're going to learn that really quick. And even to, like, on a real, like, painful level, like, your mom and dad aren't going to get it. Your best friends aren't going to get it. And they're not going to support you. And they're just not. And you're going to have to make it stand on its own. And it's humbling. Going through that, like, you feel like, well, do I have any real friends? I'll never forget this starting GreenPal. Like, we have several hundred thousand people using this app, but the first few years, the first year, it was all about, I need like 50 people using it so I can get the feedback to almost as beta testers to understand what we're trying to build. And like my best friend at the time, I was like, hey, man, will you use this app that I've built? And he's like, hey, you know, I've got my guy and I kind of like him. I don't feel like changing. So, yeah, no. And my mom wouldn't use it. My own mom wouldn't use it because she was so particular about the way. So it's like, my point is like, it's a humbling thing you can do with your life. And don't expect anybody to care because nobody's going to care. And you're going to have to do it because you want to see it come to life. And you'll be better for it. I'm better for it. because it's like, you know, humility is a great thing. And starting a business is a feedback machine in terms of just giving you a daily dose of humility. Even when you get to where we're at, you know, we're 20 something million dollars a year in revenue, it still feels like day one, because it's just like we have so much further to go, and every day we're still humbled. So great exercise in like daily dose of humility starting a business at all levels.
Yeah, I think that keeps you hungry as well, to always to realize that everything's day one. And I totally relate to that. When like you have this idea in your head, you're excited about it, you're like, oh, I think we're going to change our industry, I got this. And then you go to your friends and tell them, and they're just, oh, okay, that's cool. They don't really get it. And so you're just like, oh, no one really cares.
No.
But I also think that's very freeing as well, that no one cares ultimately, even with things like social media, that no one really cares because things move so fast.
Yeah. They only care if you can solve their problem. Mm-hmm. And I have friends now that use that app like hell, because it solves their problem, which is quite frankly easier to order a lawn mowing service on GreenPal than it is the order. And it's not that they they don't care because like they're haters. You will have haters, but it's that they don't care because they don't get it. They never built anything. They never built anything from scratch. They don't know what that's like. Now, I do have some friends, and did then and still now, that were also in like startup land that did help. They know how hard it is. They're like, yeah, I'll use your crappy app. And I use their crappy app. And I got a guy that, you know, I've been friends with for 10 years who's starting a new crappy app, and I'm using his crappy app. You know, I don't have any need for it, but I'm using it, telling him what I think. And so there's people that are in the game will get it, but most everybody else won't.
Yeah. And so another thing here is that working in the business, on the business, and on yourself 7 days a week. And that, does that still apply to you, or do you think that's a lot to newer entrepreneurs?
It's dynamic. So this concept of working in the business, on the business, is stolen or borrowed from the E-Myth by Michael Gerber. And that's really all that book is about.
It's a good book.
Great book. Necessary reading for anybody starting a business, tech startup or otherwise. And so, you know, the premise is like in the early days, you're working in the business a lot, but you still got to like carve out time for working on the business. So if you had a bakery, it means cleaning the oven, baking the pies, sweeping the floor, checking the cash register, doing the bookkeeping. That's in the business. On the business is, how am I getting the market? What's the marketing strategy? What's the recipe look like? How are my recipes better than anybody else's? My inventory control system, my employee training system, my standard operating procedures systems, that's on the business. And so like, you know, year one, you might be 90% in, 10 on. And then as time goes on, you kind of want to flip that. You want to be 90% on, 10 in, because you've delegated these tasks out. And so all of that is like really good heuristic for understanding. As simple as that sounds, most people don't think of business that way. They just roll in and just do everything, and they don't even know what the hell they're doing. And it's not going towards any kind of goal. But if you can think about it that way, it helps. And then on top of that is working on yourself. You know, you are going to have to become a good manager, good leader. If you want to start a tech startup, you're going to have to learn how to write software, the right code. You're going to have to learn about user experience design, copywriting, behavioral psychology, customer acquisition strategies, online marketing, SEO. The list goes on and on and on. You are going to have to acquire these skills. You can't just delegate all this stuff out day one, because you don't know what the hell you're doing. You got to learn the 80-20 of all this stuff. And so the third kind of dimension is working on yourself. And so that's why I still think it's a 6-7 day a week thing, because even now, you know, I'm 10 years in, and yeah, sure, I'm in Barcelona, Spain right now, kicking it, but I'm still very much working on myself, and I'm working on the business, and in the business very little, but on the business and on myself is what dominates my time now. And I think if you can move into those kind of quadrants, those are higher leverage activities. You want to try to move into that, but you got to start with working in the business, and you can kind of like dynamically move and spend more time into these higher leverage activities on the business and on yourself.
Yeah. And so a thing that me and my friend were talking about this week as entrepreneurs, and I still consider myself very much an adolescent. And so it's this concept of being able to have a hard time turning it off. So like everywhere you go, even when you're hanging out with people, work and your business is on your mind. And so is that a natural part that is just going to always be there? Or do you think that just you just learn to kind of effectively balance that out as you go along?
Look, dude, I'm out here in Barcelona, Spain. What am I doing?
Right.
I'm on a podcast with you. You know, like it's never off. It's always on. At least that's for how it's unfolded for me 20 years and going from 0 to 10 million twice. Mm-hmm. And I'm not tooting my own horn. I'm very much an adolescent too. You know, like I want to get to 100 million. I'm very much a minnow. I will tell you it's always on. And the people that are telling you that it's not always on are trying to sell you a course. And I'm sure there's exceptions of people that have work-life their balance from 0 to 1 and have meditated. And I'm a big fan of meditation, but sometimes the spiritual crowd can like be counterproductive, but have kind of, what's the word I'm looking for, manifested their way from something to nothing or nothing to something. But it hadn't worked for me. And it's been 7 days a week, thinking about it in the shower, thinking about it when your head hits the pillow. And I think if you're engaged into the business, you're naturally doing that. You want to do that. You know, you don't want to let customer service tickets pile up. It irritates you. It pisses you off. You're going to do that while you're on vacation or while you're in line on at Starbucks or while you're on a date with your girlfriend and you go to the bathroom, you're going to answer customer support tickets because it pisses you off, you know, that those things are piling up. So that's my experience. I'm sure there's people way smarter than me that can do it all, but that's not how it's been for me.
Yeah. What was some of the biggest challenges you initially as you're building up your first business up to 10 million?
Yeah, it was. So the second company, Green Pal, some of the biggest challenges was just trying to figure out, like, where do you even focus? There's so much. There's just so much to do. And it's almost overwhelming. And really what I started to figure out in year 2 or 3 was just not even worrying about anything other than 2 or 3 things at a time. So triaging around what are the most important 2 or 3 things that we got to work on this week, and let's get those done and then worry about the other stuff and prioritize them later. And it almost doesn't even matter so long as you can get a couple of these things done. And for us, it was like, we were plagued with the problem of like lawn care services just being unreliable as hell and not showing up on the days they were supposed to. And so we spent like 6 months just solving that one problem rather than the other 99 problems that we had. We just focused on one. So like focus on a few things and execute and then move down the list was something that took me a long time to learn. And I would just like, I'd have all these different initiatives going and we wouldn't move the needle on any of them. And that was a mistake I made. And then the other thing too is like delegating and delegating from a sense of like stewardship and not abdication. So what I mean is like bookkeeping is a good example. Nobody likes to do bookkeeping. And so everybody just delegates bookkeeping and they've never done their own books. And so that's delegation from abdication. And I don't like bookkeeping. I don't know how to do bookkeeping. Bookkeeping sucks. You handle it. That's a recipe for disaster. You want to delegate from stewardship. So you've done the bookkeeping for a year. You understand what you're looking for. You understand how it needs to be done. You understand what the tasks are. You understand what the inputs are. And so when you delegate it, you can delegate it from a position of stewardship, which is here's how we do it. Here's why we do it this way. Here's the process in which we want you to do it. Here's what we expect back. Here's how long we expect it to take. Here's what we expect it to cost. And here's how often we want it done. Here's the deadline. It's like you lay it out like you want it to be, like you expect it to be done because you've done it. That's how you can delegate. And it's not just bookkeeping. It's everything. You know, doing these things yourself, getting pretty good at them, and then delegating. That was a mistake I made early on. I waited way too long to start rolling some of these things out once I had them figured out. Do that as quick as you can. And you might say, well, I don't have the money to do it. Well, you figure out where the highest leverage points are. For us, it was software developers for a very long time. We needed more guys writing code. And so we would just like try to delegate as much software development as we could to developers that were better than we were. And we just kept doing that until the next thing was more important.
Yeah. So I always hear that. I never hear it the other way around, that I delegated too soon. I never hear that. So there's always something with that.
Yeah.
And so I know you do a lot of mentorship. So I'm sure investing in yourself is probably really key to you. So what role did mentorship play in your life?
Yeah, it's a little weird. So Nashville, Tennessee, tech startup. We don't have a whole lot of like consumer technology big wins. We got a lot of music. We got a lot of healthcare. We got some wins, but they were never, none of them were in like consumer technology, like a consumer mobile app. So the first thing I did when I started GreenPal was like I bought into this idea that I needed mentors. And so I'd hit every person up on LinkedIn that had anything with technology in their bio, and I'd like beg them to go to lunch with me. And sometimes they would tell me yes, and sometimes be like, bro, what do you want to go to lunch for? Like, it's a waste of our time, which was the right answer, by the way. and so what I quickly learned was like these people are smart and they're successful. They've never built an app that people use to hire a service provider. And Mark Cuban's got a quote that says, never take advice from somebody who hasn't done or isn't currently doing what it is you're trying to do. And so I'm like, well, geez, what do I do? You know, and I quickly learned that if I was going to get mentorship, it was going to be asynchronously, which means like every conference that was around technology and marketplaces and consumer mobile and all of that, I needed to like either go to or watch on YouTube. And so that was something that was huge for me. Every podcast, every online interview, every fireside chat, every keynote, every online course that anybody who was doing the things that I needed to learn, I would just consume all that. And this is like the working on yourself thing. My living room became and still is a classroom. My car was and still is a mobile classroom. I am always trying to learn from people who are way smarter, sharper, and more successful than me, who are doing the things that I'm trying to do. So that doesn't mean like LinkedIn emailing one of these people and saying, can I pick your brain? They've already like put out there into the real world everything you need to know for the most part. And it's take that down and then move on. So for me, 90% plus of my mentorship is asynchronously, probably 20, 30 people who have never heard of me, or at least they don't know me. And I've learned a lot of stuff from them over the last 10 years, just through stuff that they're putting out there.
Yeah, that's awesome to hear. Cause I'm sure a lot of people, you know, we live in the information age, like everything you could ever want to learn is pretty much for free.
Yep.
On the internet.
Yep.
Through podcasts.
Yep.
And so the hardest part is actually applying it, organizing it in some way for you to consistently take action.
I agree. I agree.
Because I'm a procrastinator at times as well. So that's something I had to learn. So I guess, what do you see, since you do mentorship now, what are some of the more common mistakes that you see entrepreneurs make?
Yeah, I do mentorship for free as a hobby for about a half dozen people in Nashville. And the thing that I see is like this resistance to just going and getting the feedback from the customer, and this resistance to getting something in the hands of the customer, particularly though when somebody's in like the idea stages, they just want to get behind the laptop and just like build for 6 months, and they don't want to like close the timeline between where they're at and like understanding if it's a good idea. So that's a big mistake that I see a lot of. I was helping a guy, think through his idea of a marketplace that would sell excess inventory that lumber supply yards would have. And so every lumber supply yard has tons of like unique custom order stuff that's just sitting in the back, and it's like dead inventory, and there's people that want to buy that stuff, but it's just like it's Craigslist and it's just a mess. And so he's working on building out this beautiful interface between buyers and sellers to buy this crap. And I'm like, bro, how about you just go in one of these shops and say, hey, let me come in here for 2 weeks and see how much of this crap I can sell, and sell it on OfferUp, on Craigslist, Facebook marketplaces, eBay, whatever. Just get it sold. Just do it. Hand crank it. And then you'll learn what the product needs to be. You'll learn how the technology needs to be built. He's like, that's a good idea. And I said, and I bet I know what's going to happen. You're going to learn real quick you don't want to be in this business. And I don't know why, but you're going to learn. And so he did it. 2 days later, he was like, you're right. We don't want to be in this business. There's a reason why nobody's buying this shit. There's a reason why it's just sitting there. There's a reason why. And it's because, like, it's just full of tire kickers. And it doesn't matter what we do. It doesn't matter how beautiful the app is. It's not going to solve that problem. So my point is, like, he was going to spend 6 months building out this multi-sided marketplace when, in fact, you know, he learned in 2 days that it was a dead end. So I still see that, you know, in the post-lean startup era, Steve Blank era, that people still do that. I've been guilty of it too. Just get something in the hands of users, even if it's just wireframes or just a simple email list. Figure out if people will convert on it before you spend 6 months of your life or a year of your life building it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so let's talk about like goals really quickly here. And so a lot of times we come with these big ideas, we have these big aspirations, and sometimes we get kind of lost in that because it's so big of an idea that we don't take action on it or that we feel overwhelmed on it. And so I think I heard you somewhere talk about kind of having big goals, but still being able to take small action. So it's basically holding two things in one hand. And that's kind of like the paradox of owning a company.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and I read somewhere that the hallmark of a beautiful mind was the, or brilliant mind was the ability to hold two conflicting viewpoints in your head at the same time. And so this is kind of one of those things. It's to have a successful company, you got to have a really big vision. You can't start off with a half-assed vision or like a half-assed, I just want to have a pretty good company. I just kind of want to be like pretty good in my marketplace. You know, I just kind of like want to have a profitable small size company. It's not going to really work because the incumbents players are going to kill you. You'll never gain market share. With some exceptions, you know, but most of the time that's how it works. So you have to have this like big vision, big unique goal, that's huge. And then you have to like think and act very, very small over and over and over again for a very long period of time. And that's tough to do, you know, it's because like, you know, when I was starting GreenPal, you know, I wanted to have the like biggest marketplace in the country for this type of service. And now today it is, but back then it didn't exist. And I mean, dude, my co-founders and I were passing out flyers all over Nashville for the first year just to get a few hundred people to use this crappy app that we had built. And so it was a very small thing we had to do because I knew if we could get to 100 users, then I knew we could get to 1,000. I knew if we could get to 1,000, we'd get to 10,000 and then 100,000. I knew that. So thinking and acting small against a very big vision, and you might think of it like a Super Mario World. Maybe you want to beat Bowser, but you don't need to be worried about Bowser on level one. You know, you really need to just get through level one, throw up the flag, and then worry about level two. Get through one level at a time, however you codify that. And it could be revenue, it could be progress, it could be customer base. But don't even worry about levels 8, 9, and 10 bosses when you're on level 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah, that kind of sounds like how I run my miles. Like I might have 20 miles to run, but I'm just going to focus on mile 1 and then 2 and then 3 and then 4 and then eventually I'll get to 2. So
yeah. And that's such a good way to look at it, but even that's hard. You know, that's a great metaphor. Business is a marathon and you know, it's such a great metaphor, but it's hard to do.
It is hard.
My shins are hurting just thinking about it.
I think one of the toughest challenges now in business and entrepreneurship, I think it's just focus.
Yeah.
And sticking with one idea. Because I even catch myself at times, my industry, do certain things. And I'm like, maybe I should do that. You know, maybe I should adopt that now instead of just really giving my plan time to stay put. So I guess with that, when do you know when to pivot? Or when you know when to stick with something?
Yeah, the shiny object syndrome. And
yeah.
The concept of the pivot is great, but it's also like a limiting. It's also like a hindrance, I think, more so than it is a benefit. So some of the greatest companies to ever be built were the products of pivots. It's crazy. Like Instagram was a pivot. You know, the first app was Bourbon, and it was just like a photo filter app, and they realized it should be this. And then Slack was a pivot. These guys had built a video game, and inside of the video game was a little chat application, and the video game sucked, but they took the chat, made it its own thing. So these pivots, when done well, really are magical. But the pivot gets bastardized where, like, take my friend, for example. You know, I see this over and over and over again. It's like they'll go and spend 6 months building the thing, and then they didn't catch lightning in a bottle. Time to pivot. Mm-hmm. And it's like, no, you actually never really did any hard work. Like, you didn't take any time. You didn't. You got to give it time, and you got to go grind your first 20 customers, and then grind to 100, and then to 500, and then to 1,000. And so I think the pivot in some ways is giving license to a breed of entrepreneurs and a generation of entrepreneurs that when success just doesn't magically come after a certain period of time, it's pivot time. And pivots occur when you set down a path and you worked your ass off and it just isn't going to break out. And you see that. But you also see this thing that you learned that if you just threw all of your weight into, could be a bigger thing. And it was because of this journey that you uncover that thing. That's what a pivot is. And I bought a domain. I got the trademark. I set up a website. I coded some stuff together. Nobody came. Time to pivot. That's not a pivot done well.
Yeah, I like that. I like that advice right there. And, you know, one thing about entrepreneurship is that it can be stressful. It can be time consuming. And one of the things that is often neglected on the back burner unintentionally is our personal well-being. So I'm curious, how have you maintained your health over the years? Because I know you said you had to learn this the hard way.
Yeah, I did. I put on like 30, 40 pounds the first 3 or 4 years building Green Pal. And, you know, it's just something I had to learn the hard way. I felt like crap every day. I was eating terrible. I was just, you know, in the office 7 days a week. And the work had to be done. You know, somebody had to do it. And so, you know, my co-founders and I were doing this. And, but my personal health got neglected. And so my co-founder said, well, I'm going to run the Nashville Marathon in the spring. And this was probably in January. And he said, you should try to do it too. And so we both signed up and just started doing the Hal Higdon training. And I learned a lot doing that, that there's this like beautiful parallel between, you know, particularly marathon training and building a business. There's all sorts of things that principles that are the same, and it's consistency and discipline and starting small, big goal, doing little things over and over again. It adds up. Faith, like having the faith that if you do the things the right day in, day out, that it will start to pay off. Little weird things like, you know, when people are training for a marathon, you know, in the city streets, you know, you see these people goofily, you know, running in place at the stoplight, and you're like, why are they doing that? And then you start training for a marathon, and then you realize that it's a lot harder to stop and then restart. And just keep running in place. And so business is like that. If you stop cold and don't work on it for a month or 2 months, you know, it's done. You know, it's going to be really hard to fire it back up. And so like there's all these things with respects to keeping your physical fitness in shape. And these things really do bleed into one another. If you're able to crank off 5, 10, 15, 20 miles, you're just sharper mentally. I know that's been the case for me. If you're 20, 30 pounds overweight and you can't run a mile, you're just not sharp as you could be. Certainly a lot of examples of overweight people who are brilliant, like Reid Hoffman, for example, one of the smartest dudes ever. You know, that dude will tell you he's a little overweight, but he's odds are if he ran a marathon, he'd be even smarter. That's my point. It's like the best version of yourself does come from physical fitness and in all aspects of life. And that's how it's been for me. Like I'm at the top of my game when I can run 5 or 10 miles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can totally relate to the it's harder to get back going once you stop, because I remember one of my long runs, I caught a little bit of a cramp, and it got, and I should have just kept powering through it. But I was like, you know, I'll walk a little bit to let it subside. And so it subsided, but then I got going again, and it was, my legs all of a sudden, all of those endorphins and everything just stops.
Yeah.
And my legs just felt like jello and it just so heavy. Right. Yeah. So that is so true. So it's better to run a 15 minute mile. If this mile takes 15 minutes, it is better to run this 15 minute mile than to even just like walk it or something.
Yeah, because, I agree.
Oh man, that is such a great parallel in business. And so one of my last questions here is that pretend you got a bottle of wine say you're in Spain, you got a bottle of wine and you got three seats to join you at this table. And who would you ask to join you? And this can be anyone, dead or alive from history, but it has to exclude family.
Ooh, well, if I'm just shooting for the moon, I mean, let's get Steve Jobs at the table. Okay. Let's get Travis Kalanick and let's get Brian Chesky. Let's get all three of those guys. Okay. So if you know Brian Chesky, CEO, co-founder of Airbnb, Travis Kalanick of Uber, and then of course Steve Jobs. Let's get all three of these folks. I think those are three of the greatest product people ever. Mm-hmm. Particularly Steve Jobs, of course. So it'd probably be the three of us learning from Steve Jobs, now that I think about it. So yeah. we'd probably need to say Steve Jobs, Ben Franklin, and Abraham Lincoln or some shit. Mm-hmm.
But you know, even still, whichever list that you use there, all of those people are innovators. And so that's kind of what you are inside your company and what you've done in your industry. And so
I'm an innovator in a very small little way. And it's like you don't have to invent Uber. You don't have to invent Airbnb. You can innovate in some small little way, do something better than the status quo and create a breakthrough doing it. And I'm the example of that. You know, I make lawn mowing as easy as pushing a button. It ain't going to save the world, but it's a convenient thing that people like to use. It also helps people make money cutting grass.
Absolutely. And I think this is a great idea. And I think this is a great example for entrepreneurs and just anybody who out there who wants to maybe get into this field and way of life, but they're worried about finding the next unicorn. You don't have to find the next unicorn. It's basically, how can I improve someone's day-to-day life? How can I provide value to the world in a better, efficient, more effective way? And I can get service for it.
Yeah, exactly. Like the founders of Airbnb and the founders of Uber didn't even set out trying to start a unicorn. Uber was just limousines. Airbnb was just couches. All of these things, everything that's huge and big starts off very small. And that's how you're going to have to think about it when you're starting from zero and trying to get to one.
Well, yeah, this conversation has been awesome. I think very action-packed in this interview here. And so where can listeners keep up more with you?
Yeah, anybody that's listening to this doesn't want to cut their own grass, just download GreenPal in the App Store or Play Store. Anybody wants to get at me, I put all of my time in Instagram. So just hit me up, Brian M. Clayton. Shoot me a follow, shoot me a DM there, and I'll hit you back.
Okay. All right. I will have all that in the show notes. And until next time, listeners out there, stay awesome, be limitless, and as always, go be superhuman. Peace.